Call the House Rules Committee to order at 9:06 on March 31st, 2005. For the record, the record show that Representative, we're joined by Representative Coring, Representative McGuire, Coghill, Lookberg, Harris, and Berkowitz. I believe that Representative Cartula is excused today. We have on the calendar House Bill 95, Public Health Disasters Emergencies, House Bill 88, Offenses by Minors Against Teachers. With that, Representative McGuire, would you like to give us a thumbnail of what we're doing with HB 95?
Yeah. In a nutshell, and Dr. Monsinger is here, Mr. Chairman, this bill is the quarantine bill. Alaska's one of the few, might be the only state left. We're the only state left without a provision for quarantining, which obviously gets some people excited, and we understand that. We worked really hard on the bill to make sure that the appropriate due process provisions were in place. It's when you have highly communicable disease outbreaks and such as a SARS or one of those type of epidemics. And but one thing that we did do is Dr. Monsinger, they had accepted an amendment that would allow for a civil cause of action against a state employee. And when they went back and looked at it, they decided that a criminal penalty would be more appropriate. And I agree with that. So what we're doing is we're actually expanding the different places where you could have a cause of action against a state employee that would abuse their power, essentially. And these are serious things. It's like the DNA bill. You want to have a provision in there that says you can't just use your power with the government badge behind you, if you will. So we create a Class B misdemeanor, and that's the first thing. The second bill is proposed by the nurse practitioners, and would add them to the list of folks, the medical folks in the bill. And I support both, but Dr. Monsinger is also here if you want to hear from him.
All right, what's the will of the committee? Would you like to move the amendments we have before us so the doctor can talk to you about that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if that's what it sounds like you want, we'll, what do you want? Amendment number one is which one?
That would be the F2, Shell 32405, right. Marked as amendment number one. President Harris.
Mr. Chairman, I move for consideration amendment number one, which is the F.2.
Do I hear objection for purpose of discussion?
I object, and I'd actually move to divide the question.
Now, let's see. Representative Berkowitz, why don't we do this? Just hold off on that motion until we hear the testimony, and then we'll all consider your motion at that point.
Where do you want to divide it, right here?
Yeah. I'll withdraw the motion and divide it.
At line 9? We'll take that up after we hear the testimony. Dr. Munsinger, if you could come forward, please.
For the record, I'm Dr. Monsager. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Health, Chairman Rookberg, members of the committee. Thank you for a few minutes. I'm going to just make a 2 or 3 minute introduction and then talk about the amendments. Most of you on the committee have already heard about this bill, so I'm not going to repeat myself for those of you I've talked to. As Representative McGuire said, we're the only state in the country that doesn't have adequate quarantine and isolation authorities in the for generalized for some unknown condition at the present time. You have in your packet a series of slides, of PowerPoint slides. I'm not going to propose to use them for discussion. You can use them for reference. It summarizes the journey the bill has made through the committees so far and improvements that have been made up till now. I think the bill does three things of importance for the state. One is it updates our public health authorities, that most of which haven't been updated since territory days, and brings them up to date with today's issues of both infectious and chronic diseases. Two, it puts due process provisions into the bill for somebody who might think that or wants to appeal an action that one of our staff might propose to do. It right now, with our current statutes, you're really at the mercy of a judge in different parts of the state, because there is, as Department of Law lawyers have told me, we have very thin statutory basis behind what we do today for control of tuberculosis and other diseases. And three is it updates the standards and management of identifiable health information and states what tests we have to meet if we're going to look at somebody's health records, and then confidentiality issues and so on. The amendments that are before you in amendment number one is a response to an amendment that was added in Judiciary Committee. The amendment that was added in Judiciary Committee is on page 16, lines 22 to 25, and that's what's proposed to be deleted. The in replacement for that, the administration is proposing that the first two parts of the amendment on page 2 put us as employees of the department at a same level of expectation by the public as any other healthcare practitioner in the state. If we don't manage medical treatment, we're held to the same standard as any other doctor or nurse in the state. And if we don't meet medical standards of care, then there's liability for that, for not doing appropriate medical care. The middle part that's on page 9 following line 17 puts in place a part C around the identifiable health information and makes that a criminal penalty if we knowingly violate the disclosure of health information. And those are proposed to substitute as a change, not a substitution, a change from the civil liability authority that had been added in the on page 16. In our view, it's appropriate that we as individuals be held to a standard that imposes criminal penalties on us as individuals. We have an ethical standard to meet the standards of the professions, and is also matched in, for example, I'm a pediatrician. If I were to violate health information of some patient I take care of, in our state statute, that's a Class B misdemeanor as a physician anyhow. So it matches that level of penalty. The other part of reason for withdrawing or for taking out the civil liability, and I'll let person from the Department of Law speak, Dan speak, is that the quarantine and isolation authorities, if anybody appeals, the courts are involved for everything except an emergency order by medical officer, and even that has to be taken to a court within 72 hours if somebody doesn't think we're managing appropriately. So it puts the court into play, so to speak, if any of us were to do something that's inappropriate. So in our view, we think that this would be an appropriate change to the bill as it moves through the legislature. With that, I'll be quiet and answer questions.
Thank you, Doctor. My questions and the witness. I have one, perhaps, I don't know, either to yourself or Mr. Branch. By way of background, you indicated that currently if you a licensed physician in the state reveals patient information that they're subject to criminal prosecution as a misdemeanor?
There's both federal HIPAA standards that we need to meet.
Is it state or is it federal?
That's federal statute.
State provisions? There was for criminal prosecution. Is that correct?
Okay. He doesn't think so.
Mr. Branch, can you want to weigh in on that as to...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Dan Branch, I'm with the Department of Law here in Juneau. I'm unaware of any penalty, the state penalty, that for a private physician breaching confidentiality.
I know we had it in the Patient Bill of Rights that I authored, or there's standards of privacy, but I don't recall any criminal sanctions. That's why I wanted to bring that up. So it would be under a federal cause of action or a criminal action?
I'm not sure how it would proceed. I know the HIPAA standards place a heavy burden on the state and the physicians to protect confidential information or identifiable health information. Representative Roekberg, if you like, I'd be happy to double-check and let your aide know what the answer to that is.
I appreciate that, because we're creating a new crime that is not currently covered in, albeit this is for a different, I guess you're using the analogy about it. But this crime is, in this amendment, is specific to that act, not divulging private information.
It is actually a better analogy would be to other provisions we have to protect the confidentiality of information. For example, child protection information is protected in the same way. If somebody releases confidential information regarding a child in violation of provision in 4710, then they're liable for a B misdemeanor. So we're essentially, that's the analogy I think that's more appropriate here. And there's, I believe, other examples in state law as well.
Representative Berkowitz.
Maybe I'm not understanding. So if someone knowingly quarantines someone, how is that distinguishable from kidnapping or falsely imprisoning someone?
Representative Rochberg. Representative Berkowitz. The bill would not make it a crime to violate the quarantine isolation provisions. As Dr. Monsanger explained, there's no need to have a civil cause of action for suing a state for a violation of the isolation quarantine provisions, because the rights provided by that provision to the respondents can be enforced within the hearings that are provided by the statute itself. If a person is wrongly quarantined, he will be able to come before a judge and tell his side of the story and have an attorney help him with that. And if you can't afford an attorney, then the state will pay for it. So at the time when it's most important to protect the individual's rights, there is already a remedy provided by the bill. So that renders it unnecessary to provide a criminal sanction for a violation of the isolation quarantine provision or a civil sanction in the opinion of the state.
Follow up.
That presumes that the individual knows to get an attorney or is capable of getting an attorney.
I believe the provision, I'd have to double check, but I believe it provides for a requirement of notice to be given to him. If you give me a moment.
So wouldn't the Criminal Act be give rise to counsel under the AG, or you could?
Yeah. Well, it's not. I mean, if in essence, I'm saying that if there's a knowing violation, a knowing quarantine, even though it's improper, what recourse does the individual have?
Would he not go to the Attorney General's office if he thought it was advantage or injury?
You've got a circumstance, though. I mean, the history in this country for imposing quarantine isn't particularly impressive. I mean, we've imposed quarantines for all kinds of nefarious reasons. And if you have an individual in a community who wants to impose a quarantine on somebody in violation of these rules, I wouldn't think that they'd necessarily then say, even though I'm imposing this quarantine in violation of these rules, I'm nonetheless going to inform you of your right to an attorney. And that's one of the reasons why I'm hesitant to carve out the liability. I think the state's liability is one of the reasons we'll keep the infrastructure of the state very vigilant before anyone imposes a quarantine and make sure that there aren't any kinds of misbehaviors. But I'll tell you, in my experience, I know plenty of cases, I know of cases where there has been disclosure of health information in communities, in small communities, and it's been done for vindictive reasons.
Well, isn't the act of quarantining, in essence, a public notification in and of itself? But it doesn't have to be specific to an individual, does it?
I don't understand.
I mean, when you quarantine, it's like noticing the public that you're restricting access to either groups or individuals or geographic areas. So that's a actual, if not constructive, notification.
But if I were to say, all right, Representative Rochberg, I'm going to quarantine you. I'm going to take you and put you in our little quarantine cell. How would anyone know where you were or what you'd done? I mean, there's no, and if I'm doing this for improper reasons, knowing violation of these rules, what recourse are you going to have?
Well, we have the Constitution, I think.
Well, you say a person. We're talking about a department, and if an individual, if I understand your question, if an individual in the department makes a spurious claim to actually quarantine somebody, then it would probably be more proper to hold them criminally liable, wouldn't it?
Right, but you can't hold, and if you keep the state civilly liable, you're going to make sure that the state remains vigilant about its personnel. The whole idea of we talk a lot in this building about accountability and responsibility, and if we're saying that the state's not going to be held accountable for the actions of its workers, the state's not going to be held responsible, it's real tough for us to pass the message of accountability and responsibility on. And I understand that lawyers for the state don't want us to be liable at all for anything. That's their job. But I think we send a message every time we make the state exempt from liability.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McGuire.
Well, you know, we could debate all day long about whether it's a stronger message to have a criminal penalty or civil penalty. But I certainly think that having a criminal charge brought against you for your actions is much more of an incentive as a state employee to be accountable. $1,000 civil fine is what the old law said. And that's one permanent fund dividend check. So I think having a criminal record established for your conduct is much more severe. And the other thing that I think is really important too, it's hard because the bill is so big, but you have to take it all together. And if you go back to page 12, just as an example, we really tighten this language up in judiciary, and there are very specific circumstances under which the government can even quarantine you. And it has to be that this is the least restrictive alternative. There isn't any other alternative that you could come to. And the department then has to go through the following conditions and standards, and they're quite cumbersome. They do have to give notice. They have to receive an order from a court, from the judicial branch of government. It's a written order from the Superior Court. And we spent a lot of time tightening up. This goes now on page 13. What we wanted the petition to that Superior Court to allege. And it's very specific. We want, you know, the time and date of the isolation of the quarantine, who this individual is. So this idea of someone locking you up somewhere and nobody ever knowing is just preposterous. It won't happen.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berkowitz.
I agree. When people follow the rules will work. But when people don't follow the rules, then there needs to be some kind of recourse for the victims. And the victim here would be someone who was falsely quarantined or improperly quarantined. And when the rules are followed, I have no quarrel with this bill. But when the rules aren't followed, that's what I'm standing up and saying, that the people who have been victimized by a false quarantine ought to have some recourse to the state. And we would hold someone liable, criminally and civilly liable, for a kidnapping. And I don't see much difference between a knowing false quarantine and a kidnapping. And I don't know why we'd exempt the state from its responsibility to make sure that its employees are behaving properly.
Representative
Cogle. I tend to agree with the speaker. However, we're putting in the rules for the state to act, so we would be the one to hold them accountable. If an individual misused this state law or circumvented the state law, then they should be held criminally liable. And I think that's what we're trying to get to.
But a criminal liability doesn't make the victim whole. I mean, you put someone in jail, it doesn't help the victim get their life back, necessarily. And I think that if you want someone who's been a victim to have the opportunity to make themselves whole, then you need to allow civil liability.
Well, Mr. Branch, if someone felt that they were improperly quarantined, do they have any recourse to appeal to the courts for relief from that quarantine?
Yes, I believe they would. The bill provides, actually, that we have to go to court, except in unusual circumstances, to get a quarantine order in the first place. So the
first remedy would be to appeal to have the quarantine set aside.
Yes.
Everybody's being unduly.
And I think the bill provides for requests for review as the quarantine goes on, if the person thinks it's no longer necessary.
Our discussion really should focus on the sanctions of what should be meted out if in case there's abuse of the system.
Right.
Any further discussion or questions of the witness? Representative Chris, did you wish to make a motion?
Actually, if I could divide the question, I think in three would be the most appropriate. That's after. If I could divide it in three, that'd be three. After line 9 and after line 16.
Well, the chair will rule it is divisible, although I'm a little skeptical about your division. So we'll mark the first section, Amendment 1A, the second 1B, and the third 1C. Is there any discussion on 1A?
Yeah, I just want to point out in response to something Representative McGuire said about this bill addressing the least restrictive means of quarantine. One of the other amendments we have talks about or the most effective. And that to me is a huge potential broadening of when people can be quarantined and how they can be quarantined. So I think there should be some concern about that. But fundamentally, it's a question of whether you think the state should be liable when its employees do something wrong. And I think the state should be. The state has a responsibility as an employer. It should be no different than a private employer.
Further debate on Amendment 1A. Hearing none, what's the will of the committee? Is there objections to Amendment 1A?
Yes.
There's objections. Could the clerk read the roll, please?
Representative Petula absent. Representative Harris?
Pass.
Representative Coghill?
Yes.
Representative Coring?
No.
Representative McGuire?
Yes.
Representative Berkowitz?
No.
Chair Roper?
Yes.
Representative Harris?
Yes.
We have the Amendment 1A is adopted, and we have now before us. Excuse me, to have a brief at ease. The adoption of Amendment 1B, page 9 through line 17, and represents line 10 through 15 of the F2 amendment. Representative Berkowitz.
I have a question about this. Is there any criminal penalty then contemplated for someone who knowingly quarantines or isolates in violation of the statutes?
Ms. Branch, you want to respond?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, no.
Further discussion on this amendment?
Well, Representative Berkowitz, I don't see why you would disagree with this. This expands.
I don't.
Okay, that was my question.
Well, I'm just pointing out, though, that this is solely for...
That's correct. This is for the identifiable health information.
Right,
but I mean, this is an expansion of rights.
But there's no concomitant criminal penalty for a knowing violation of... quarantine or causing isolation. And this is, so in other words, if you knowingly quarantine someone falsely, there's not even a criminal penalty.
I thought that's what this is.
No, this is just for the disclosure of health information.
Oh. You want to speak, Dr. Monsager?
Doctor, for the record, sir.
Dr. Monsager, for the record, through the chair, Representative Berkowitz. As I said in the introduction, the only time an employee of the department could quarantine somebody is in an emergency and is for a maximum of 72 hours. Every other time, a court has to be involved. And so I can't see how there could be a knowing quarantine or isolation. At its maximum, it could be 72 hours, and a person has the right to appeal. So the remedy is to the courts in an immediate fashion.
I agree under the best of all circumstances, but I could say, doctor, I'm quarantining you because I want to use your house for the next 72 hours. Totally improper, but if I have the authority to quarantine you, I can quarantine you. And that's in knowing violation of all these statutes, and yet I can't be, there's no direct criminal sanction that would attach.
You wish to make an amendment?
Mm-hmm. I would support that.
I would do a conceptual amendment because I'm not sure.
Amendment 1B, conceptually, Mr. Berkowitz.
That would also bring in knowing violations of quarantining or isolation.
And that would be under 1855.385 because that sets out the.
Whatever the relevant sections on here.
Yeah, it would be an amendment to the amendment number 1B.
Chairman?
Subsection B.
Chairman, just a question to make of the amendment. Then, is the penalty you're giving for that just a Class B misdemeanor?
Well, that's, I mean, that is a problem, it seems to me.
Well, I was going to ask you earlier if you wanted to make it symmetrical with kidnapping, which I'm sure is higher than a Class B misdemeanor. But we don't need to get into that right now, do we? Or do you want to?
You know, I don't know how. I mean, I would suppose that the prosecutors would have some discretion as to how to charge in these circumstances. But I don't know.
Well, this is a House bill.
Okay. Well, then I'll pursue.
And I would like Mr. Brandt to step forward here. If you have any recommendations on trying to wordsmith this a little better, it is a conceptual amendment.
The conceptual amendment is to make it a B misdemeanor to violate 385.
Right.
That's right.
Is that the relevant section?
Let's see.
That's the big, that's the meat.
I think we.
That's all the requirements that are spelled out. So isolation and quarantine.
I think that's okay then. Janet, you think that's good enough? Conceptual amendment? I think it is. Does everybody understand what the conceptual amendment is? The violation of 385 would give rise to a misdemeanor also, together with the disclosure of identical health information. Is that correct, Representative Berkowitz?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any objection to the amendment to the amendment? Seeing none, we'll adopt the amendment to the amendment. With that, amendment number 1B as amended is before the committee. What's the will of the committee? Is there any objection? Seeing none, amendment 1B as amended is adopted. Now we have before us Amendment 1C. Is there any objections to Amendment 1C?
Yes.
There's objections. You want to speak to your objection?
I don't want to delete this material. It stayed off the hook, and I don't think the state should get let off the hook.
Further discussion. Representative McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chairman. This is a debate that we have carried out. It's an extension of, I would say, 4 years of debate, and it's a difference in philosophy, fundamentally. We spent the last couple of years rolling back some of the sovereign immunity, expanding some of the sovereign immunity provisions in the state. And again, it's a question here of what you think is more appropriate. And I think a criminal penalty sends a very strong message. I'm very pleased with what we did in expanding it to 385. I think it makes it clear that we want government workers to go through all of the proper steps. But frankly, you know, putting a civil cause of action, and remember what it does, when you put that out there, it gives a liability that sits out there. It's a cause of action that you're creating, a civil cause of action. And these are state employees that are out there doing their job. And I just think that's onerous. We don't have a precedent for it. We had the DNA bill, which I would say falls right in keeping with this in terms of real sensitive kind of government work where you've got people's health information, you've got their privacy at stake, and what we chose to do there was a criminal penalty as well. So it would be highly unusual to go against that grain and start creating civil penalties. A civil cause of action against state employees. So I think the criminal penalty is appropriate. I think we've expanded it, and I think we ought to accept this amendment.
Representative Harris.
Lisa, so if this amendment passes, we're deleting any reference to civil penalties, but because of the last amendment we passed, we've added criminal charges.
That's correct.
All right.
Mr. Speaker, that's correct.
And so to get back to the comment that Representative Berkowitz made earlier, and you just made an eloquent speech about it, but why would it not be, again, appropriate for somebody who was subject to the violation of this law to not be able to receive civil penalties?
Well,
civil consequences.
Through the chair, Mr. Speaker, again, you know, it's a philosophical difference. You know, these are people that are making government wages, being asked to do very difficult work. If you can imagine a circumstance where a quarantine would come into effect, absolute chaos. They're working as fast and as quickly as they can. They know they've got a criminal penalty hanging out over their head for every single thing they do. But then to say, by the way, you've got civil liability exposure hanging over your head as well, which in this case, all compensatory damages, we don't know what they are, and a fine of $1,000 for each single violation. It's quite a lot to say. Those civil actions hang over your ability to get loans, to buy houses, whatever. They follow you forever. And I just think that the more appropriate remedy when you are dealing, again, know that we've kind of pigeonholed the argument in this one place, but this is for public health. This is for the benefit of all of us, and God forbid we ever have a circumstance like this. But when we do, these are the individuals that are on the front lines that we are asking to do yeoman's work. And I just don't think it's appropriate that we do the civil penalty. I think Representative Guerra, when he offered it in the right spirit, in the sense that we do want to hold him accountable. And that's where the criminal penalty comes in, and I think with Representative Berkowitz's amendment, it makes it even stronger. But I think that to then say you've got a civil cause of action hanging over your head, it might even be a deterrent to doing that kind of work.
That's what I was going to ask. Dr. Mansinger, you want to testify on that real quick? If there was a possibility of a civil penalty, $1,000 per infraction, I guess it would be, hanging over their head, would that be a major deterrent to somebody's desire to go out and deal with this type of situation?
Representative Harris, through the chair, this amendment has caused a great deal of distress with the staff that do this kind of work for exactly that reason. It's not so much the $1,000 as it's the compensatory damages, too, that they would be personally liable for. And they're doing work, as Representative McGuire said, usually in a thoughtful manner and usually with time to think about it, but in an emergency where they have to work quickly, if this is lying out there, I'm really worried about our ability to recruit staff if they think that they are personally liable for the actions they're going to take.
Thank you, Doctor. And I, for one, represent the West Anchorage District, includes the Anchorage International Airport, the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport, really. And I've had an opportunity to talk to the good doctor about this, and very sensitive to where we are in terms of the international trade traffic and the importation of various infectious diseases. This is very, very important. I think it's we need these tools, and I appreciate the comments made by the doctor, and I'm going to be voting in favor of this amendment as a vote of support for our staff and the people that work for us. With that, is the objection maintained?
Yes, it is.
Objection maintained. Could the clerk read the roll, please?
Representative Harris.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Representative Coghill.
Yes.
Representative Corey.
Yes.
Representative McGuire.
Yes.
Representative Berkowitz.
No.
Representative Petula, not present. Chair Rothberg.
Yes. 1C is adopted. We have before us now Amendment 24.
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw Amendment number two.
Yeah, 4-1.
Yes.
All right. Okay.
If I could offer it? If I divided it or just deleted the first two lines?
Let Representative McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I first looked at this amendment briefly this morning, I thought that all we were doing was adding in nurse practitioner and expanding the definition. There's two things that I would be willing, the only thing I would be willing at all to do would be on page 20, line 18, that part that deletes nurse and puts licensed nurse or nurse practitioner. But I'm a little concerned even about that, because I don't know if that means a flight nurse. So upon further reflection, I wanted to withdraw it all. The first part is absolutely egregious. I mean, I do not, Representative Berkowitz is exactly right. We don't want to change restrictive to most effective. I think that expands the authority, but beyond what we want the government to have. The second part that regards highly toxic agents and so on, we worked on that in judiciary and went the exact opposite direction after debate. So I don't want to go back in time on that. So it's my decision anyway to withdraw it. If Representative Berkowitz wants to offer a part of it, then.
Mr. Bitney, did you want to make a comment at all or not?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is John Bitney. I'm representing the Alaska Nurses Association, who put forward some of the points that this amendment covers. The most effective or most effervacious.
Excuse me one moment.
Sure.
I'm going to move Amendment 4F for the record, just so we have it before us. And if you can object.
It'd be 4F?
It's F.4, I mean.
As Amendment 2.
As Amendment Number 2, yes. Now we have it before us, and I hear objections.
Object.
Rejections, and now we have before us, Mr. Bitney. Forgive me for interrupting you.
Forgive me, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. The most effervacious or effective, or however it came out in drafting, was intended to sort of get at, you know, if these people need to be set aside in quarantine to be effective. Of course, we've tried to put sort of double barrel language in here, but I guess upon further reflection and talking with the department and the administration, we sort of realized that this opened up more than we had intended to with the language. And also, Dr. Monsager did explain to me yesterday that the toxins and things like that are covered in another part of the bill in work that was done. Again, the idea here was to, the bill speaks mostly to contagious diseases, and we just wanted to make sure that things like dirty bombs or other sorts of things out there that aren't necessarily contagious but could perhaps be transmitted from another person should also perhaps be considered subject to the bill.
Mr. Bitney, about the line 20, page 20, line 18, delete nurse, add licensed nurse, nurse practitioner. Did you want to speak to that?
We would ask the committee to consider adopting that, Mr. Chairman. A licensed nurse would essentially be an RN as opposed to perhaps an LPN or some other kind of nurse. It would speak to a licensed nurse as well as the addition of a nurse practitioner.
Well, I'm going to move to amend by deleting all material on the entire amendment with the exceptions of lines 16, 17, and 18 on page 1. Therefore, amendment number 2 as amended would read page 20, line 18, delete nurse, insert licensed nurse, nurse practitioner. Is there any objection to the amendment to the amendment?
Mr. Jim?
Representative McGuire.
I just want to ask Dr. Monsinger, is there a place that you can envision for public health benefit that an LPN or one of these other classes of nurses should be included, again, for the overall goal being public health? I don't know the answer.
This is Dr. Monsager again for the record. Representative McGuire through the chair. If you look at the list of people that this replaces, and frankly, I was very surprised yesterday to find out that we didn't have nurse practitioner in there already. How many times have we read this bill and we had missed it? Interestingly, Dan Branch just reminded me on page 20.
And 13.
Line 13 in the definitions, we included nurse practitioner. Good. Then we didn't mess up. The question you're asking is, should we keep a general nurse there that includes LPN and others, since nurse practitioner is already identified above? I'm ambivalent. I think I'd rather keep a wider range, just leave the word nurse, as long as we kept nurse practitioner, because they're independent prescribing practitioners in the definitions of healthcare practitioner.
So you're against the amendment, any,
Well,
Representative McGuire.
Mr. Chairman, I just, you know, I understand that there are places where you want a nurse practitioner, and I'm supportive of Mr. Bitney and the nurse practitioners. That being said, they are mentioned in line 13. I think it's clear the bill covers them. What I don't think you want to do is exclude pieces of this public health model that, again, an LPN is also a highly trained nurse. They just don't rise to that next level. I just sitting here right now, not being an expert in public health, I can't envision what the scenario is, but I wouldn't want to exclude that person if it was in the best interest of all of our health.
Very good. With that, I'll withdraw the amendment to amendment, and then amendment number 2 is off the table. We have been assigned to Berkowitz, who has distributed an amendment to page 26, following line 30. We'll mark this amendment number 3. Representative Berkowitz.
Sure, and just this should be for House Bill 95, not 96. I don't know what 96 is, but it's a small glitch there. and I would move the amendment and
Object for purpose of discussion, Representative Berkowitz.
Thanks very much. And it's a totally separate subject. I'm sure it's nothing that was contemplated, but it was a big, wide title coming by, and I thought I'd take advantage of it. There's across the country, there's something called health information networks that are developing. And as part of those health information networks, there are a lot of grants that could be available to the state. And the health information networks have been touted for a lot of ways, as you know, by President Bush, among others, about ways to improve the quality of health care and reduce some of the costs. And there's some grants available, and I hope with this amendment it would encourage public health system to apply for some of those grants.
Representative McGuire.
I don't have any objection to the amendment, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a good amendment. I've been working on that obesity bill, and just got notified of one of those grants that's available for obesity public health work. So I don't have an objection to it at all.
Mr. Chairman, I personally don't have any objection to the concept. I'm just wondering if we're putting it in the right vehicle. That's all.
Well, I have the same question here with Christmas tree.
Well,
never let it be said that I would ever
hung an ornament on yourself once or twice.
I think our healthcare research is obviously the greatest expanding cost in almost all of our budget areas is healthcare costs, and we're going to have to look at it. But public health alone isn't the only place I think we should look at it. I think going to the Health and Social Services Department, and I think maybe a budget bill would be a better place for the language. If he could get the budget committee to entertain this language, I'm sure that that might be one thing to do. But I just wondered if we put it on here, if it wouldn't just fly under the radar screen, that's all.
I've already got the attention of the people I needed.
Representative Berkowitz, what would you like to do with your amendment?
I'd like to continue to move it for discussion. And all we're encouraging the Department of Health and Social Services to do is apply. We're just encouraging them to apply. We're not mandating that they apply.
You think this fits under the title without a title?
Well, I just would like to point out that this is an act relating to public health, among other things.
It sure is.
it's very germane to the title.
Any further discussion? Any objection? You made your objection. I did object. Okay. I would withdraw my objection. So amendment number 3 is adopted.
You got one. You can't have any more.
Yeah, that's it.
I've got 2.
Get 2.
Yeah, you're batting 1,000 here today.
Oh, I'm about to. My average is going to go down right now, but.
You don't have your name on this one.
I don't need to do that.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
I know where this amendment came from.
Of this?
Yes. I need to go make some more.
Actually, I handed out several.
I don't know, but I need to make some more.
Here, you need it?
We'll mark this as amendment number 4 by Representative Berkowitz. And this is inserting the following language in the AS 4707020 sub B, etc. Representative Berkowitz.
Yeah, and I'd move the amendment.
This amendment of order. I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Berkowitz.
Thanks very much. This is a Denali Kid Care amendment. And this would, when we changed Denali Kid Care a couple of years ago, we locked into some numbers. We didn't lock into a percentage of poverty line. We locked into some numbers. And as a result, fewer and fewer people are taking advantage or are able to take advantage of Denali Kid Care, which I think is one of the most successful programs that the state ever conducted. It was a step that we shouldn't have taken. I think given the budget surpluses that we have today, we can make health care available to a wider range of people, and we ought to do so.
Very good. I'm going to maintain my objection to this amendment and indicate that while I appreciate the makers of the amendment's desire to make a significant change in state policy, I don't think this is the appropriate venue or bill for that discussion. And
Mr. Chair, this is the Rules Committee, and
that's right.
This is an act relating to public health.
Mr. Chairman.
Right. Representative Cox.
Has this bill had a Finance Committee referral?
Does it have a Finance Committee referral?
Did it have one?
I don't. Representative McGuire did. I don't believe it did. Is there a fiscal note on this thing? No.
Well, there certainly would if this amendment passed.
Yeah, right.
I can guarantee you that right now.
Right. Really upset the apple cart.
This would definitely have to go back to Finance if it.
I'm sure we have the same idea here. But with that, I'm going to call a question on this amendment. And Representative Berkowitz, you're going to maintain your amendment?
Yes, I am.
I would like to have the clerk read the roll, please.
Representative Cox.
Coming out.
No.
It seems.
Representative Perry.
No.
Representative McGuire.
No.
Representative Berkowitz.
Yes.
Representative
Petula,
not present.
Representative Harris. No. Amendment has failed to gain its traction.
Chairman?
Representative McGuire.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer a conceptual amendment to tighten the title to House Bill Number 95 to more accurately reflect the quarantine and other, and it might end up being a page long, but I'd rather have that than go through this on the floor.
Chair accepts amendment, conceptual amendment number 5 to direct the drafters to tighten the title and clearly reflect the nature of the subject matter of the bill. Is there any objections to amendment number 5? Seeing none, so adopted. Any further amendments come before the committee on HB 95? Seeing none, what's the will of the committee? Representative McGuire.
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for House Bill Number 95 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Any objections? Seeing none, so moved. Next, we have before us House Bill 88. Let's see.
Don't be mad now.
You should be happy.
He's going to come quarantine Ethan Berkowitz's district.
Ah, you see,
the big red flag around all
on voting day.
But he'll have a lot of money to do it.
Yeah, that's right.
Mr. Roro.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee, for hearing House Bill 88 today. My name is Randy Barraro. I am an attorney in the legislation and regulations section. I'm not a criminal division attorney, but I try to help out when they're caught up in other hearings. So I'll do the best I can. House Bill 88 is supported by the Anchorage School District. I've spoken with Ms. Como. She strongly supports the bill. And I believe the Fairbanks School District has submitted a letter of support for the Senate version. Three substantive sections of the bill, sections 2, 3, and 4. Section 2 would create a new aggravating factor for certain crimes against a person or arson committed on school grounds or a school bus. Section 3 would limit a existing mitigator that's been applied in at least one superior court in a way that we don't believe was originally intended. And what they've done there is they've taken the mitigator for assisting authorities, and at least that Superior Court has found that it can apply that mitigator even in subsequent cases, so that the person who assisted authorities even 5 to 10 years ago and perhaps got credit for an offense at that time can claim that credit again in future cases. We don't believe that was the intent of the original language, and this just makes it clear that the mitigator only applies for the offense that's before the court at the time. Section 4 of the bill would automatically waive into adult court 16 and 17-year-olds charged with certain serious crimes involving misconduct involving weapons, using a gun at a drug deal, attempting to use a gun at a drug deal, or shooting at someone in a drive-by shooting. The Criminal Division has reviewed Representative Hawker's proposed amendment and supports it.
Is this Hawker's?
Yeah. Who's going to? Representative McGuire, are you going to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hawker is carrying this on the floor. Do you want me to respond, Chairman?
No, we have an amendment.
Oh, to the amendment? You want me to offer it?
Please.
Mr. Chairman, I offer amendment number 1, which is, I guess it's I.1 lockup.
I'd object for conversational purposes.
Objections noted. Representative Berkowitz.
I have a couple of questions. On line 16, it's operated by a public or private agency. It seems to me that's pretty much everything and everybody. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, I can tell you the genesis of the amendment. It was the Covenant House in Anchorage, where they have a lot of youth in treatment for drug issues. And apparently APD's found that dealers are aware of that fact, and they're hanging around those types of treatment facilities and trying to sell drugs to the kids, you know, because they know they're trying to stop. There's a demand there probably.
I understand that, and I'm supportive of what's trying to happen. What I'm real concerned about is the looseness of the language in the amendment. I mean, when you talk about a public or private agency, that's everything. There's nothing that's not public or private. Not this building, not Covenant House, not your house, not my house. That's a public or private agency. And I've got kids, so I am operating a private agency that provides shelter training, and I would hope some guidance for minors. There's an overbreadth issue that arises out of the language here, and I would think that to get where you want to go, you need to be more precise.
But through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, I understand your concern, but I think if it wasn't broadly stated, because these types of treatment centers and other places are operated by both, you know, public and private entities, you know, nonprofits, I think that's why the language was left, you know, intentionally broad, maybe, so that you could cover all the different types of organizations that offer, you know, assistance to youth.
Am I wrong? Does this not include my house?
Through the chair, I'm not sure that a house or a private residence would qualify as an agency. It's certainly, you know, I guess we could put on the record that it's not intended to apply to private residences. But the broad language was, I guess, felt needed to be broad to cover, you know, you may have a 401c3 operating something for youth. You may have, a public state or, I guess, federal program operating a program for youth. So they did try to keep it broad so that all the kids could get the protection, you know, of the section.
Representative McGuire.
through the chair, Randy, what if we said operated by a public or private agency that is licensed to provide? Doesn't Covenant House, don't those groups have to go through and get a license?
Through the chair, that I'd assume they'd at least have to have a business license. I'm not sure what other specialty licenses they may have. There may be licenses for providing counseling services. I'm not 100% sure.
I have one that's formally organized and operated. Because licensure rights, licensure, unless you were to be more specific, would, you'd have to adopt the license under Chapter 8, you know, under our licensing, OCC licensing.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, anyway, how does that sound? Just in, after, on line 16, before operator to add the word formally organized, it's a little bit inartful, but... What do you think, Representative Berkowitz?
I just, one of the concerns I have with agent is agent, or agency, is that agent is defined in 1171-900. And I don't know if there's a tie-in, but agent in that case means an authorized person who acts on behalf or at the direction of a manufacturer, distributor, or dispenser. And it doesn't really, I understand what you're trying to get at with agency. Mm-hmm. I sort of like where Representative McGuire is going, but instead of agency, I might even say entity.
Entity. Organization. Pretty broad.
But, just very leery, if I could, Mr. Chair. In the criminal law...
It's a big deal. It's an auto waiver.
Huge. It's huge.
I know. But I believe the amendments... shows value, because this goes back to the criminal history of increasing and aggravating activities around school buildings where children are congregating. And that's the intention here, because as I understand it, there's actual targeting going on by purveyors and sellers of drugs and so forth at these particular locations, because they don't have the aggravators in them. So that's the intention here. So I think it's a meritorious. So we just need to get the words right.
Mr. Chairman, what if we said operated by a public or private entity that specifically provides, or something like that?
Or formally organized to provide.
Formally organized.
That gives rise, it shows the legislative intent that this is not just private residence.
Formally organized public or private entity that specifically provides shelter, training, or guidance for minors?
Organization has a definition.
Oh, it does.
1181-900, which is, my preference is to go with words that are already being used.
Yeah.
Without objection, you can read from there.
No, it's too long. Too many multisyllabics. in some ways, the cleanest is operated by an organization that is licensed to provide.
Licensing, I have a little bit of difficulty with, because Shiraro's right. You could say a business license is licensed. But that might give the...
That might be all that those... Some of those licenses have.
But it's... that's all you need. I'm just very leery about bringing in private homes.
Unless they're licensed to provide something.
Right.
I would think, Mr. Chairman, because I know we have some shelters that are nothing other than residences that somebody takes the time to open up their doors, and mm-hmm. and they have a whole cadre of youngsters there. So
it would, we have this, we're having an informal work session here, operated by a public or private organization licensed to provide shelter training or guidance for minors, is it?
Yeah.
So we just add organization licensed.
But does that, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Does that exclude what Representative Coghill's concern was, that a residence could get licensed?
No, I think they should be able to be licensed.
They do.
I
mean,
if they're licensed and organized to do that.
Okay.
Many, many small counseling groups work out of private homes or so forth, so that shouldn't be. But it's a formal business.
Or to meet the zoning requirements, huh?
Yeah, it's got to be a health service provider.
Well, even you have to get a license to be a foster. Yeah, you have to go through that process.
Okay. So, let's see, I would offer the amendment to the amendment on line 16. After the word private, delete agency, and add the words organization licensed. is there objection to the amendment? To the amendment, seeing that it's so adopted, that brings before us amendment number 1 to House Bill 88, Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objections to adoption of Amendment Number 1? Seeing none, so adopted. Is that it?
I have actually some proposed deletions, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Berkowitz.
He misses judiciary, Mr. Chairman.
I do. This is my only committee, so I'm subjecting you to a lot of frustrations. I would propose that we delete Section 3 and the portion of the title that reflects it, and I can speak to that.
I'll object to it, but so you can
you're
speak.
Making a conceptual amendment number 2?
Yeah.
To delete Section 3. There, I hear objections, Representative Berkowitz.
You know, my concern is that a lot of times law enforcement officers are able to make deals with people may not relate to a current offense. And without hearing more fully about the impact that this amendment would have on law enforcement's ability to get the most out of the phones, I don't think we need to change this, especially if it's only based on a single case that should have been problematic. We don't know of all the good that's been done through this.
Representative Berkowitz, it looks like this is the snitch provision here. What is this amendment doing here? Why are you objecting to the amendment again?
Well, what's happening with this section adds the words after commission of the offense for which the defendant is being sentenced. So after someone commits a crime, then he helped authorities to detect, apprehend, or do what is ever necessary. Let me give you another example. What if someone tells you about a crime that's about to happen that he or she might be involved in? That's not after the commission of the offense.
Mr. Ferraro, do you want to comment on this?
Yeah, sure. Chairman Roekberg, the language has been vetted with District Attorney Bob Linton in the DA's office in Anchorage. He feels it will still work fine I'll try to describe what he commented to me was that their ability to get information wouldn't be compromised by this, that they could still operate fine, and that the concern was, you know, that even though it's occurred only in the one case, other superior court judges could also find that way and start applying, you know, the mitigators to cases where people had assisted authorities, you know, years ago and gotten credit already for the assistance. So they were trying to stop that doubling up, tripling up of credit for that mitigator. But I can say that District Attorney Linton did not feel that this would compromise their ability to get information in any way.
Richard McGuire.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this kind of expands on the bigger criminal bill that we did too. It might even allow a defendant who's on the hook for a completely separate crime to provide information about this crime and potentially get a mitigated sentence. So I think that's another concern that you have. Right?
Yeah. I appreciate that you spoke with Bob Linton, who I actually worked with many years ago. I'd feel much better if he were to come here and tell us it's not a concern so we could give him some of the hypotheticals that we have issued.
Mr. Rar, is this, from your testimony, it appears that there is some case law actions on the part of the judiciary that gives rise to this particular provision?
Through the chair, it was a superior court decision, to my understanding. I wasn't the assigned attorney on the case, but to my understanding, it was a superior court decision in a felony case out of Ketchikan, where the one of the superior court judges gave the defendant credit for a mitigator for an act of assisting authorities that was prior in time to when they committed the offense and related to a different case, but still found, wiggle room in the language and exercised his discretion to apply the mitigator.
Well, I can appreciate that, but I think I share Representative Berkowitz's concern. If you don't get mitigation for an action that's not taking place. I mean, that's prevention of crime, isn't it? I mean, what are we doing here? Representative McGuire, you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I do, Mr. Chairman. I think, I do think and agree with Randy that there's enough wiggle room in there to get at what you want, but this is again, kind of a fundamental philosophical question. I mean, do you want more crimes mitigated or not? And I think the fact of the matter is you do want to allow for a mitigator when somebody is assisting, but the problem is we've really broadened this. And with this Superior Court decision, which I've never seen, but I think that's disconcerting to think that you could go back in time, apply a mitigator to a completely separate occasion. I think we do want to clean it up. But again, that's my fundamental, you know, philosophical belief is the fewer mitigators, the better. So.
Objections
the amendment.
Are maintained on the amendment. This is a vexatious one. Any other opinions?
Shoot.
Ethan's just grinning. He just wants to exercise his brain today.
Right, yeah. Any further discussion on amendment number 2, is it? Help me.
Two.
Seeing none, I guess the clerk can read the roll.
Okay.
Representative Corey.
Yes.
Representative McGuire.
No.
Representative Berkowitz.
Yes.
Representative Petula, not present. Representative Harris.
No.
Representative Coghill.
No.
Chair Roper.
No.
Chair DeFore.
Better luck next time.
Okay, well, next time is now.
Now, Representative Berkowitz, are you going to call up the district attorney and let us know? So
yeah, I'll call him. I appreciate that.
If you know him, that would be good.
I have a question about Section 4. And my question is, why does the language that's bolded there not directly track 1161-190?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, when the bill was in the House Judiciary Committee, there was some discussion about the situation where, well, let me back up a little. It doesn't track exactly 190 because 190 includes a section that talks about shooting at property. It was amended in the House Judiciary Committee that the situation should be limited to factual cases where there was actually a person that was threatened by the shooting. So they narrowed it to reflect what's underlined there now.
I could. The language that's in 190 that's not here is that the discharge of the firearm from a propelled vehicle while the vehicle is being operated. I mean, that's the language that was taken out.
Sorry, what?
It's under subsection 2.
Has there been something removed?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, I was talking about the deletion of or damage to property. That language was the part that I remember being dropped in the Judiciary Committee.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, my apologies. It's hard when you don't have all the statutes in front of you. But the concern, we spent about an hour on this and going through, and it was Representative Guerra was going through a variety of hypotheticals. And because this is the underlying point of this bill is it's an auto waiver for a minor into the adult system. And so it's a very serious thing, and you want to be very careful about when you do it. And the concern was that when you start involving shooting, discharging a weapon at property, surrounding property and things like that, you really end up with some circumstances that I don't think you want to get at for auto waiver. And so what we tried to do, at the risk of it being a bit messy, is to deviate from the original statute and make it more narrow.
Make it more what?
More narrow.
Narrow.
Yeah, I think, Mr. part of the discussion was that the crime against the person rose to the level, but the crime against a property didn't rise to the level of the auto waiver.
Good, we have that in the record. Do you have any further discussions on that?
Not at this time.
Any more amendments?
Not at this time.
Any further comments? What's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill number 88 as amended with individual recommendations and attached response.
It's attached. Previous fiscal notes 2, 3, and 4.
Previous fiscal notes 3 and 4.
Excellent motion.
I'm sorry.
Motion before us. Is there objection, Rex?
On the fiscal note issue, because I didn't see a Department of Corrections fiscal note. And I also noted that some of the fiscal notes said that it may or may not lead to increased costs. And frankly, that's sort of a flip response from the administration. I mean, that can be said of anything at any time. And it's a little bit of a troubling use.
Well,
Representative McGuire.
Mr. Chairman, that particular fiscal note you're referring to is generated by the House Finance Committee. And I suspect it had more to do with the fact that, you know, that's not their area of expertise than anything. I doubt it was flip. But probably the testimony they heard was that it might lead to more prosecutions. It might lead to the same amount of prosecutions, but sending juveniles to adult population, which may or may not be more expensive. I mean, I think there are a lot of variables that we don't know.
In my packet, I don't have a corrections fiscal note on this.
They had an indeterminate fiscal note and been done with it. But they didn't, so it's way to go.
Anyway,
it's out of our purview. That's an interesting question. Do you maintain your objection, Representative Burke?
No.
Objection review. Is there any further objection? Seeing none, then House Bill 88 does move out of committee as amended and so forth as the motion was before us. Thank you. With that moves, and then we're going to be adjourning this committee at 10:20. Thank you very much.